This is Audible.
University Press Audiobooks presents When They Severed Earth from Sky, How the Human Mind Shapes Myth, written by Elizabeth Wayland Barber and Paul T. Barber, narrated by Beth Richmond, based on the book published by Princeton University Press. Transfers to devices are permitted. File sharing and peer-to-peer usage are not permitted. Chapter 1. Time Capsules. The son of Danae slew the Gorgon, and bearing her head adorned with locks of serpents, came to the islanders bringing them stony death. But, to me no marvel if the gods bring it about, ever seems beyond belief. Pindar, Pythian Ode 10. Evidence shows that people have had brains like ours for at least 100,000 years. By that time, as the excavated bones show, our vocal tract had developed for speech as we know it, and language could not have come into being without both an efficient vocal mechanism and the complexly structured brain necessary for language. But if people were so smart, just like us, 100,000 years ago, why do the myths they passed down often seem so preposterous to us? And not just to us, even ancients like the Greek poet Pindar, who made his living telling such stories circa 500 BC, sometimes felt constrained to a disclaimer, "Don't blame me for this tale." The narrators present these myths as histories. Yet how can we seriously believe that Perseus turned people to stone by showing them the snaky locked head of a monster, or that a man named Heracles, or Hercules, held up the sky for a while, slew a nine-headed water monster, moved rivers around, and carried a three-headed dog up from the land of the dead, or that a man named Methuselah lived for almost a millennium, that an eagle pecked for years at the liver of a god tied to a mountain, or that mortal men, Beowulf, St. George, Siegfried, and Perseus included, actually fought dragons? And how can one view people like the Greeks or the Egyptians, who each believed simultaneously in three or four sun gods, as having intelligence? Didn't they notice a contradiction there? Why did people in so many cultures spend so much time and attention on these collections of quaint stories that we know of as myths? The problem lies not in differing intelligence, but in differing resources for the storage and transmission of data. Quite simply, before writing, myths had to serve as transmission systems for information deemed important. But because we, now that we have writing, have forgotten how non-literate peoples stored and transmitted information and why it was done that way, we have lost track of how to decode the information often densely compressed into these stories, and they appear to us as mostly gibberish. And so we often dismiss them as silly or try to reinterpret them with psychobabble. As folklorist Adrian Mayer points out, classicists in particular tend to read myth as fictional literature, not as natural history, not least because humanists typically don't study sciences like geology, paleontology, and astronomy, and so don't recognize the data. In order to understand how and why myths were constructed to encode real and important data, we must come to understand the possibilities and hazards for the collection, processing, and transmission of information in non-literate societies. Just how much can you keep in your head? Simply put, writing allows people to stockpile data in masses that are not possible when one must rely on memory alone, and it allows people to transmit as much as they want without much compression to future generations. Conversely, without writing, people had both to winnow out the key information, presumably according to perceived importance, and to compress it by any means possible until it fit into the available channel, human memory. We have come to term this overarching problem the memory crunch. During 24 years of empirical research on myths from all over the world, we found that many of these stories could be understood through a series of simple, observable principles. These principles show how particular types of myths developed out of actual events, how people crunched down the information into the limited channel available for transmission, enhanced its memorability, then shot these little time capsules of knowledge down the pipeline to the listeners of the future. Not all myths are of this type, of course, but many more of them turn out to stem from actual events and real observations of the world than 20th century scholars have commonly believed. And possibly all types of myths can be understood better through understanding the close relationship between myth, language, and cognition. At any rate, myths encoding verifiable facts proved the easiest place to begin recognizing the cognitive processes involved. Working initially from a few myths whose historical or archaeological origins are independently known and verifiable, we first noticed a dozen or so rather specific principles. One of us works principally in Old World archaeology and linguistics, the other in comparative literature and folklore. This empirical list increased slowly to about 40 principles over the next 15 years as we happened on more and more usable data. Then, abruptly one day, they all collapsed down into 4 overarching principles, each of which has clear correlates in linguistic process. Why were we so surprised? After all, myth is transmitted through language, and it is the same human brain with its peculiar design features that must handle both language and the data it encodes into language. These myth principles start to make the inner workings of myth rationally intelligible on many levels. Discussion of the 4 fundamental mytholinguistic principles, silence, analogy, compression, and restructuring, forms the greater part of this book. For each, we present the more specific principles we discovered that fall under its sway, together with parallel insights about language and a multitude of examples from world mythology. If Indo-European myths, especially Greco-Roman, Germanic, Slavic, and those of the Pacific Northwest preponderate, that is where the combined knowledge and interests of the present authors are strongest. What this book is not about is archetypes, the stuff of C.G. Jung and Joseph Campbell. Those aspects of myth that appear universal are, in our opinion, the result of pitting human cognition against the small channel problem just described, common responses to common problems. Why would one want thus to strip the veil of mystery from mythology? Some people won't want to. They don't have to read this book. But for students of cognition, the practical structure of myth gives interesting new insights into the language-oriented brain that spawned myth. And for archaeologists, the decoding of myth provides the possibility of restoring a certain amount of actual history to the prehistoric world, the world before writing. Writing was invented a mere 5,200 years ago, but we have been speaking and presumably myth-making for 100,000 or more. That's a lot of history lost. To recover what is left of these precious time capsules, we begin with some of the most transparent mythologies available and build our way, principle by principle, toward the naughtier stuff. Chapter 2. The Memory Crunch. How long a pipeline? Memory crunch. When all accumulated wisdom must be stored in the brain and transmitted orally, as in a non-literate society, people reserve the formal oral tradition for transmitting the information they consider most important, often for survival. A story from the Klamath tribes, recorded in 1865. A long time ago, so long you cannot count it, the spirits of the earth and the sky, the spirits of the sea and the mountains, often came and talked with my people. Sometimes the chief of the below world came up from his home inside the earth and stood on top of the mountain, the high mountain that used to be. One time when the chief of the below world was on the earth, he saw Loha, the daughter of the tribal chief. Loha was a beautiful maiden, tall and straight as the arrow would. Her eyes were dark and piercing. Her hair was long and black and glossy. The chief of the below world saw her and fell in love with her. He told her of his love and asked her to return with him to his lodge inside the mountain. There, he said, she would live forever and forever. But Loha refused to go with him. Then the chief of the below world sent one of his warriors to a feast of the tribe to plead for him and to arrange for a marriage with Loha. But again the maiden refused, and the wise men of the council would not command her to go. When the messenger returned to the middle of the mountain and reported the maiden's answer, the chief of the below world was very angry. In a voice like thunder, he swore he would have revenge on the people of Loha, that he would destroy them with the curse of fire. Raging and thundering, he rushed up through the opening and stood upon the top of his mountain. Then he saw the face of the chief of the above world, shining among the stars that surrounded his home. Slowly the mighty form of that chief descended from the sky and stood on the top of Mount Shasta. From their mountain tops, the two spirit chiefs began a furious battle. In a short time, all the spirits of earth and sky took part in the battle. Mountains shook and crumbled. Red-hot rocks as large as the hills hurtled through the skies. Burning ashes fell like rain. The chief of the below world spewed fire from his mouth. Like an ocean of flame, it devoured the forests on the mountains and in the valleys. On and on the curse of fire swept, until it reached the homes of the people. Fleeing in terror before it, the people found refuge in the waters of Klamath Lake. After a discussion, two medicine men, the oldest and most revered of the Klamath people, rose from the water, lighted their pine torches, and started toward the mountain of the chief of the below world. From the waters of Klamath Lake, the people watched the flare of the torches move up along the ridge on the east side of the mountain, to the top of the cliff which hung over the entrance to the below world. There the medicine men paused for a moment, watching the flames and smoke coming up through the opening. Then they lifted their burning torches high above their heads and jumped into the fiery pit as sacrifice. The chief of the above world, standing on Mount Shasta, saw the brave deed of the medicine men. He saw that it was good. Once more the mountains shook. Once more the earth trembled on its foundations. This time the chief of the below world was driven into his home, and the top of the mountain fell upon him. When the morning sun rose, the high mountain was gone. The mountain which the chief of the below world had called his own no longer towered near Mount Shasta. Then rain fell. For many years rain fell in torrents and filled the great hole that was made when the mountain fell upon the chief of the below world. The curse of fire was lifted. Peace and quiet covered the earth. Never again did the chief of the below world come up from his home. Never again did his voice frighten the people. Now you understand why my people never visit the lake. Down through the ages we have heard this story. From father to son has come the warning. Look not upon the place. Look not upon the place, for it means death or everlasting sorrow. Who can doubt that we have here a volcanic eruption, with its river of fire, quakes, ashfall, and lava bombs? Certainly no one who has followed the recent eruptions of Etna, Pinatubo, and Shasta's neighbor, Mount St. Helens. Active volcanoes outside of Hawaii generally erupt rather seldom, in human terms, maybe once every few centuries or millennia. Yet when they do, they wreak havoc, and it is just as well not to be living in the path that the lava and other lethal flows will take. So one can understand that people who had experienced devastation from a fiery mountain would view it as a life and death matter to warn their descendants of the danger. But the message might have to traverse hundreds or even thousands of years to do its job. Is transmission of oral information across centuries even possible? We read in the newspaper about how unreliable the witnesses to accidents and crimes can be a month later. What hope is there that verbal information could survive so long intact? The Klamath story quoted refers specifically to the place we know as Crater Lake. In fact, the story was related as answer to a young soldier at Fort Klamath when he inquired why the native people never went to that breathtakingly beautiful spot. Geologists have reconstructed that a volcano dubbed Mount Mazama formerly towered 14,000 feet high between Mounts Shasta and St. Helens. It certainly once qualified as high, just as the story says, and equally correctly, the giant is no longer there. After emptying its magma chamber of lava in the catastrophic eruption, Mazama collapsed to form a crater 4,000 feet deep, which, as the narrative relates, never erupted violently again, and gradually filled with water to form today's magnificent Crater Lake. That eruption, so accurately described and vehemently warned against in the tale, has been ice dated to 7,675 years ago. So, yes, real information can reach us intact across more than 7 millennia of retelling. Even if we might not agree with their explanation of why these things occurred, the Klamath tribe in the 1860s still knew in considerable detail of events observed millennia earlier. Nor is this longevity of information an anomaly. Investigating another part of the world, Bruce Massey reports his surprise at the realization that the majority of Hawaiian myths were firmly attached to Hawaiian chiefly genealogies, which purported to go back in unbroken lineage for more than 95 generations before Kamehameha I, including several Pele myths in which the volcano goddess had battles during the reigns of named genealogical chiefs, battles that resulted in the production of discrete named lava flows whose locations were known historically. Much to my surprise, the radiocarbon dates for these lava flows matched not only the relative order of the named chiefs in the genealogical record, but closely matched absolute dates, as well as if a 22-year period were used for the length of each chiefly generation. Evidence abounds from several continents, in fact, that properly encoded information has passed unscathed through the oral pipeline for 1 to 10,000 years and more, for example in Australia. But the conditions must be right for this to happen. First of all, the information must be viewed as important, as in the Klamath warning about innocent-looking Crater Lake, which, for all they knew, might explode again next week. Similar taboos against entering the heartland of a former vast catastrophe came to exist among Evenki shamans and herders after the 1908 Tunguska cosmic event, which was thought locally to have resulted from two shamans battling. After all, you can remember only a limited, even if fairly large, number of stories to pass down, so anything added to the corpus of stories to retell had better deserve its place. It is ousting something else. This being so, we can state as another working hypothesis the relevance corollary. that formal oral mythologies are neither unimportant and off the wall, nor random in their content. Second, the information must continue to correspond to something still visible to the hearers, such as Crater Lake to the Klamath. If tellers of volcano myths migrate away from all volcanoes, the original meaning of those myths is sure to become clouded or lost. The third condition for intact transmission is that it be encoded in a highly memorable way. If Uncle Nestor, so boring he puts everyone to sleep, is elected clan storykeeper, the stories aren't going to survive. Best would be to elect Uncle Mitty, who can turn the dullest incident into a cliffhanger. But even Uncle Benji, the village idiot, incapable of really understanding any of the stories, can do the job if he can remember and repeat them just as he heard them. An unbroken chain of good memories is part of the condition, but that chain is more likely to stay intact if the information is either embedded vividly, so as to be more memorable, or encoded into the story multiple times, so there is a backup. The two methods are not unrelated. The latter strategy is called redundancy. Communication theorists like Claude Shannon have studied the properties of redundancy in information systems since the 1940s. Language itself is about 70% redundant under normal circumstances, just to ensure that our messages get through all the noise, literal and figurative, in the system. To convince yourself of this high redundancy, consider telegraphs. Telegraphs were billed by the number of words, so people used to cut costs by paring out as many redundant words as they could locate, leading to what is still known as telegraphic speech. For example, reached Paris, send money, trimmed to half the usual words. Evelyn Waugh once reduced his discovery of the untruth of a story, that an American nurse was killed when an Abyssinian hospital was destroyed, to the two-word cable, nurse, un-up-blown. A professor of cuneiform studies at Yale used to tear columns of the New York Times in half lengthwise, then make us reconstruct the text from just one half, to get us in practice for deciphering broken clay tablets from the Bronze Age. Early in the column, you're in doubt about how to fill many of the blanks, but by the time you get partway down, key words have occurred in your half often enough that you can go back and fill them in, thanks to redundancy in the message structure. In the story of Crater Lake, we heard about the anger of the chief of the below world, but also about his curse of fire, about the battle waged, about all the hot rocks and ashes flying around, about the river of fire coming down, and so forth. Two or three of these could disappear without the central events and message getting lost. Sheer redundancy in the text helps, but the more vivid each event or image in the story is, the less likely it is to drop out. The image of two elderly medicine men hesitating with their torches on the rim of the caldera, then jumping straight into the lava, will stick in most people's brains for quite a while. Why do some things stick so? Cognitive scientists have learned that recall is greatly enhanced when an image is encoded into several brain systems at once, rather than into just one, another type of redundancy. The story as told invites one to imagine the fiery torches and lava in the night, stark visual images, and the men hesitating before jumping to their deaths, powerful emotional stimuli, as well as providing a stream of words which the linguistic sectors of the brain perceive, store, and decode. So the brain may have stored it in not just one, but three or more places. These observations give us another step forward. Redundancy strategy. Because of the importance attached, Particular information will tend to be encoded with a high degree of redundancy and/or vividness, except where the piece of knowledge is believed to be universal. The last clause, the exception, is a troublesome problem paralleled in linguistics that we refer to as the silence principle. It will be explored in chapters of its own when we are ready for it. Note that what is old tends to be viewed as rather dull. A restaurant you've already been to generally doesn't excite your senses as much as a brand new one. And have you noticed, as Thomas Mann did in The Magic Mountain, how much longer it seems to take to drive to a place you've never been than it does to get home later? All your senses are furiously busy registering all that new data on the outbound. It's much duller on the way home. So a good storyteller will pepper a narrative with the new and vivid. Now, when important cultural information is being transmitted, one is not allowed to tamper with the key information. Therefore, the vividness must come in the non-central details. Note how the Klamath teller makes the girl come alive with details about her eyes, hair, and stature, all of which have nothing to do with the core message, but which help us remember that her beauty was perceived as the cause of the whole misfortune. The elderly chief who told the story was an effective keeper of the tradition, even as he embellished it. In fact, for truly bizarre and ununderstandable events, such as a huge comet appearing in the sky, or even the constellations themselves, novel associations may be the best route to memorability. Thus, it's much easier to remember the location of the pole star if someone tells you it's on the end of a big spoon-shaped group of stars and is pointed to by two stars in an even bigger and more obvious spoon nearby called the Big Dipper. Spoons, not to mention cattle and dogs and scorpions, are odd things to find in the sky. But their weirdness is just what makes the images associated with the chaotic panorama of stars memorable, even to children. The cow jumped over the moon, the little dog laughed to see such sport, and the dish ran away with the spoon. Each patch of sky becomes a giant Rorschach blot. The more picturesque, the better. Centaurs, lions, and flying horses populate our northern sky, while llamas, jaguars, and U2 birds pass above the Andes. Studies show, in fact, that human memory works far better precisely when the random data points can be shaped into interactive stories. Jeremy Campbell, the science journalist, describes a famous experiment as follows. Hermann Ebbinghaus, a 19th-century founder of scientific memory research, who used nonsense syllables in his memory tests to ensure that the pure act of recall was not tainted by meaning, found that people forget up to 80% of what they learn within 24 hours. After that, the loss is less rapid. This swift loss of information from the conscious mind became known as the curve of forgetting. Yet, the Ebbinghaus curve is not a universal law. It does not apply when the information to be remembered takes the form of stories rather than nonsense syllables carefully drained of context. The inexperienced, naive person is sometimes intrigued by the nonsense syllables and tries to make sense of them, attaches images to them, notices interesting properties of the list as a whole. Because he enriches them in this way, extending their artificially cramped context, he is able to remember as many as 75% of them a day later, throwing the Ebbinghaus curve into reverse. And so it is with memorizing constellations for such useful purposes as navigation and time-telling. Thus, the off-the-wall quality of so much inherited lore may not be a sign of the simplicity, but of the cleverness of the encoders. But there is another problem. If our theories of volcanism hold up better against the attacks of skeptics than ancient theories do, it's not because we're smarter, but because we have enough more information now, thanks to writing, to deduce real cause and effect. Some 2,500 years after the first Greek attempts at science, we've amassed far more data about, for example, geology, surveying the Earth's surface and probing its innards, so that we know largely what underground forces cause volcanoes to erupt. We even know the difference between basaltic volcanoes like Kilauea that flow like water, where scientists rush toward an eruption rather than away, and dangerously explosive volcanoes like Pinatubo, Krakatoa, Vesuvius, Etna, Thera, and the Lassen, Shasta, Mazama, Hood, St. Helens, Rainier, Baker chain up the west coast of North America. And we know that major differences in the chemical composition, and hence viscosity of the magma, cause these differences in behavior. Determining the causes of even slightly complex effects requires a lot of data, usually more than one head can hold, and more than one individual can observe. Pre-literate people were often cut off from the opportunity and tools needed to figure things out. Brain scientists, on the other hand, have found that our minds seem to insist on forming explanations no matter what. Those who study memory have learned that people are heavily predisposed to come up with after-the-fact explanations that specify a deterministic cause of the outcome. That is, our brains will, if possible, latch on to a plausible reason why an event should have come out the way it did, whether or not that was the actual cause, and this explanation will then become an inextricable part of memory. Thus, studies show that jurors apparently cannot mentally set aside evidence they've heard, but are then told is inadmissible. This phenomenon is known as hindsight bias. Those who study hemispheric functions adduce evidence that, in particular, the analytic side of our brain, the language processing hemisphere, is programmed to produce explanations for everything. This act is presumably part of its toolbox for crunching the masses of disparate incoming data down to manageable amounts, and for minimizing the push-me-pull-you dilemma by integrating the perceived world. Various experiments suggest that it jumps to conclusions, concocts what it wants, and forces behavior accordingly on the whole organism, even when other parts of the same brain have data that flatly contradict this explanation. Researchers have observed such brain fights most starkly among so-called split-brain patients, victims of a type of epilepsy not controllable by drugs, who have therefore undergone surgery separating the two hemispheres of the brain. With the corpus callosum cut, there are no pathways for most types of information to pass from one side of the brain to the other. One side remains ignorant of what is taught or shown to the other side alone, through hands or eyes. For everyone, the left hemisphere controls the right hand, and the right hemisphere the left hand. But in 95% of the population, language and one's abilities for analytic and sequential reasoning reside principally in the left hemisphere. In one particularly graphic case caught on videotape, Dr. Michael Gazzaniga of Dartmouth flashed the word orange to the patient's right hemisphere and a picture of a bird to the left hemisphere, then told the patient to draw what he had seen. The left hand came forward, chose an orange pen, drew a circle, and embellished it with a stem and some speckles, a very nice orange. "What do you got?" Gazzaniga inquires. The patient shakes his head, staring at his own drawing. "What did you see?" prompts Gazzaniga. "Orange," he says slowly. "That's the color. What did you see in the picture?" This question directs the young man's attention to what he saw with the language side of his brain, which was the only side to have seen an actual picture. "Bird. I think I started on it, but I can't do a bird too well." He smiles a bit sheepishly. "You can't do a bird too well?" Gazzaniga echoes. The patient shakes his head slowly, while his left hand picks up a pen, approaches the drawing, wavers, then throws the pen down with a frustrated motion. "I can't do it." "Try it with your right hand." The right hand quickly picks up a pen and adds beak, wings, feet, and tail to the circle. "What do you got?" says Gazzaniga. "A bird. A sick-looking bird. But I can't do birds either," the young man explains with a rueful smile. "You're not good on birds?" "No, I don't do animals." Commenting on the scene later, Gazzaniga says, "And then you say, 'Why did you do that?'" And he fumbles for a minute, and he says, "Baltimore Oriole? I don't know. I just picked up orange." So you have here the separate activities represented in the drawing. The right hemisphere picks the right color pen, draws a picture of an orange, does more than you ask, and then the right hand, from the left hemisphere, comes in and turns it into a bird, and then gives you an explanation as to why you have an orange-colored bird. This left-brain interpreter insists on interpreting action. It will not let things go. It demands an explanation. One might add, whether it knows what it's talking about or not. In fact, the language side of the brain brooks no counter-evidence. What it knows explains all by definition. Or, put another way, what the language side chooses to encode into language becomes the explanation. In the face of such a strong biological demand for explanation at all costs, what surprise is it then that people cut off from working out principles of cause and effect will turn to other means of putting together some sort of explanation? Where permanent record keeping is unavailable, so that there is not enough memory space to accumulate the data needed to demonstrate cause and effect for complex phenomena, other types of explanation may be proffered or sought. Data show clearly that the most prominent of these other types of explanation has been analogy. That is, if we can't say that X is that way because Y caused it, we can still plausibly say it's that way because it resembles, works like, Q. The stars move across the sky because they're like a river flowing past. The sun moves across the sky because it is like a boat moving along a river, or a chariot moving past us on a road. Just as we live inside a house or lodge, so the chief of the below world must live inside something, apparently a big mountain. And that explains why he could come out of the mountain when he felt like it, just as we can come out of our houses when we want. Analogy is so central a part of the principles by which myths evolve, and still today one might add of modeling in modern science, that no fewer than 13 of the roughly 50 principles we observed empirically turned out to fall under this category. They will be treated presently. But before we are ready to explore the varieties of analogy with real insight, we must understand the devil that will get in our way at every turn, clouding our eyesight and destroying our data. We referred to it once before, the silence principle. Chapter 3. The silence principle. of Lethe and the Golden Calf. Silence Principle. What everyone is expected to know already is not explained in so many words. Feedback is the mechanism by which we control the flow of information in a conversation. Every 6 seconds or so we provide it, with such automaticity that we hardly know we've done it. Station yourself near a telephone conversation when the guy on the other end is doing most of the talking. What you hear at this end is, "Yeah." "Uh-huh." "Sure." "Yeah." Time it. Every 3 to 6 seconds, the listener checks in. When the speakers can see each other, some of this feedback may be done visually, but on the phone, there's no second channel. And what are we feeding back? We're letting the other person know whether we comprehend the messages and whether the rate of information flow is about right, as in the previous example, or too fast. What's that? Did what? Who? Or too slow? Yeah, yeah, I know. We detest being told things again that we already know well. We want to move on to the new and juicy stuff. So if our conversational partner is covering too much old territory, we get more and more impatient, not to say ruder and ruder, as we try to hurry things along. If not stating the already known is a mandate in simple conversations, how much more so is it in social dealings? When we get into an elevator, we all turn and face the door and look up at the numbers of the passing floors, because we all know that in American society, you aren't supposed to stare, that is, look for more than the briefest moment, at strangers within 8 feet of you. But the elevator is so small that you're within 8 feet of everyone, so you have to put your eyes somewhere safe, up or down. We never discuss the matter with strangers on the elevator. Keep your eyes to yourself. Not allowed. Only the little kid who doesn't know the drill yet gets told off. "Freddy, don't stare at the woman. It's rude." A quick, sheepish smile to the woman, a sharp thumb in Freddy's neck to swivel him toward safer vistas. In short, the only time such things that everyone knows ever get said is when we're trying to socialize children. This rule carries over in the telling of myth. Why waste time saying what everyone knows? Get on with the informational part of the story. But what a disaster those omissions can lead to for the study of myth. For we, many cultures and centuries removed, may not know what the people whose mythology it is all knew so well and hence did not say. In short, Lethe effect. What is never said may eventually be forgotten entirely. The most famous examples of the Lethe effect have to do with the names of divine spirits. Among the ancient Hebrews, for example, the name of their god was considered so sacred that it became impious to say the name aloud, although it was written down in what we know as the Old Testament. But the Hebrew script, like the Arabic, transcribed only consonants, leaving the reader to supply the appropriate vowels. Because this particular name stopped being said, eventually no one knew anymore what the correct vowels were, so now no one could say it. All that remained was the skeleton. YHWH. The silence principle had wiped out the data. Another example of this phenomenon is what linguists dubbed circumpolar dropout, when they noticed that languages all around the Arctic Circle regularly lose their words for the major game animals hunted by people there. The cause was traced to a prevalent belief that each type of animal was protected by a spirit, a bear spirit, a fox spirit, and so forth. If the bear spirit heard you plotting to kill bears, the reasoning went, it might hide all the bears safely away, and you would starve for lack of meat. To circumvent this, you would refer to bears by a euphemism as you plotted the kill, the brown one, whence English, bear, Bruin, the honey eater, Russian, medved, and so on. Thus, the Indo-European word for a bear, reconstructed as H2RKTOS, and retained by the more southerly languages like Latin and Greek, with Ursus and Arctos respectively, was lost up north through silence. Note how hard it would be to spot the losses, the victims of the river of forgetfulness, if we did not have either written text or closely related languages to tip us off. Indeed, noticing what is not there is one of the most difficult tasks of all. Linguists clearly have an advantage here with their arsenal of related languages, and we will often turn to the linguists for help. For in order to interpret the results of silence, we need some sort of outside information to bridge the gap, whether linguistic or physical. Observe also that the context of both these examples, though linguistic, is religious belief, a central realm of mythology. Although they are harder to spot and to interpret, non-linguistic examples of the Lethe effect also abound. Let us start with a myth where the writer kindly gives us a nudge. The Icelander Snorri Sturluson, 1179-1241, relates how the gods punished Loki for causing the death of Baldur. They bound him to stones in a cavern, then took a poisonous snake and fastened it up over him so that the venom from it should drop onto his face. His wife Sigyn, however, sits by him holding a basin under the poison drops. When the basin becomes full, she goes away to empty it. But in the meantime, the venom drips onto his face, and then he shudders. At this point, Snorri clearly felt that his Christian audience, for whose education he wrote Edda, would not have learned the background necessary to interpret this story properly, so he steps out of the narration a moment, deliberately breaking the usual silence, to instruct us, and adds, "You call that an earthquake." We'll get more help from Snorri later. Now consider the golden calf. Moses comes down from the mountain at dawn with his tablets and finds the children of Israel worshipping a golden calf. What's that all about? Why a calf? Why not a goat or a dog or a manna bush? If we form the hypothesis that we are not told because originally everyone knew, we can make some headway. Where had the children of Israel been living? In Egypt, of course, the country from which they were escaping after centuries of servitude. One can reasonably conjecture that in all that time they had absorbed something of their captor's culture. In fact, Moses seems particularly incensed because in his absence they have somehow reverted to the religious practices of others. So what do we know about Egyptian religion? Even fifth graders today can tell you the Egyptians worshipped primarily the sun, something that the Egyptians' neighbors in the Levant were well aware of, considering how often they borrowed the Egyptians' winged sun disk in their art. What is less widely known, but which could well have been known by folk who had lived in ancient Egypt for centuries, was that the Egyptians viewed the sky, among other things, as a giant cow goddess standing four square over the earth, and each morning she gave birth to a golden calf. There it is, suddenly sitting like molten gold on the horizon. In worshipping a golden calf at dawn, the children of Israel would simply be reverting to Egyptian sun worship. They were probably relieved that the sun finally came up after all that thundering during the night. And why would the storyteller need to explain something so obvious? Note that whenever the Lethe effect kicks in, we run the risk of losing precious data altogether, to the point that the myth it affects may eventually become ununderstandable. Some of this loss is caused actively. Religious taboos often trigger destruction of the information, as in the case of how to vocalize YHWH. Social taboos have quite the reverse consequences. Almost every American kid soon knows all the words you aren't supposed to say that pertain to body functions and parts, and many of these terms have etymologies that go back thousands of years. Not only has it always been fun to fool Mama and Papa, it's even more fun to flout them. whereas offending an omniscient and probably omnipotent spirit is another matter. But other losses occur quite unintentionally, as when we omit saying what we think everyone knows. As long as the culture remains essentially unchanged, as long as children grow up socialized into the same knowledge base as before, lethe is held at bay. But as soon as major migrations or technological revolutions occur, so that the circumstances to which the myths refer live only in the minds of those who knew life before the change, then the trouble begins. The meaning and references of the Klamath tale were quite clear to the 80-year-old Chief Lelek who related it. From where he sat, he could still look up at the remains of the dangerous mountain. Although technology was beginning to change with the coming of the white man, the locale, at least, was still the same, so his interested young listener could see the evidence and understand it, too. But what happens when the new generations can no longer perceive what is referred to, either because the group moves away from the relevant data, or a new cultural group with totally different values moves in or takes over? We, for example, are likely to view the following passage from a Modoc story from Northern California as fairly quaint and arbitrary at first glance. Late one spring, while the Sky Spirit and his family were sitting round the fire, the Wind Spirit sent a big storm that shook the top of the mountain they lived in. It blew and blew and roared and roared. Smoke blown back into the lodge hurt their eyes. At last, the Sky Spirit said to his youngest daughter, "Go up to the smoke hole and ask the Wind Spirit to blow more gently. Tell him I am afraid he will blow the mountain over." His little daughter was glad to go. She put her head out of the hole and looked toward the west. The Wind Spirit caught her long hair, pulled her out of the mountain, and blew her down over the snow and ice. She landed among the scrubby fir trees at the edge of the timber and snow line, her long red hair trailing over the snow. But there is real information in there. Focus on the long red strands trailing down a mountain inside which is a smoking fire. This story, in fact, concerns Mount Shasta, another very active volcano that is so high, 14,400 feet, that permanent glaciers cloak it. Apparently, the tale records a relatively minor eruption that included a lava flow coming partway down the western flank. We'll find hair as an image for lava repeatedly as we proceed. In fact, the volcano myths told by native peoples of the Pacific Northwest, odd though they may seem at first, are still fairly reconstructible to us, because we are the first new people to come into the area since the events occurred, and we know how to ferret out the geological data to verify them. But imagine how muddy the waters would be if the original observers had passed their stories on to new people, who simply took them at face value and then repeated what they could recall of the seemingly random details, finally passing a garbled version on to yet another group who knew even less about the subject, and so forth. We face this situation in Greece, for instance, where Minoan stories passed to the incoming Greeks, who gave them to the Etruscans and Romans next door, and thence to us, millennia and several technological revolutions later, not to mention continents away. Under such circumstances, any key point or assumption passed over in silence in the original version will likely cause a vortex of confusion to grow and grow around it. But non-literate cultures are not alone in generating difficulties through what they do not say. We, too, pass over key assumptions of our own in silence, failing to recognize and cope with what we do not articulate. And this aspect of the silence principle can be as devastating to the study of myth as the side we have just explored. Imagine, for example, two people having a conversation using words which they both know, but for which they have different definitions. Decades ago, as an unwary native of the West Coast, one of us went into a cafe in Boston, looked at the menu, and said, I'll have a chocolate milkshake. A few minutes later, a glass of slightly frothy chocolate milk arrived. But I ordered a milkshake, said I. There it is, said the waiter. But where's the ice cream? I queried. Milkshakes don't have ice cream, came the reply. If you wanted ice cream in it, you should have ordered a frappé. Now imagine the conversation when the participants have really different assumptions.
Well then, who's playing first?
Yes. I mean the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The fellow's name on first base for St. Louis.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first base?
Well, what are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. Who is on first?
Well, all I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no, no. What is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well, don't change the players around.
This famous Abbott and Costello skit, of which only an eighth is quoted, twanged such sympathetic strings in the audience that it flung its authors into stardom overnight. When Bronislaw Malinowski was living among and studying the Trobriand Islanders early in the 20th century, he awoke one morning to hear loud, and it seemed to me, quarrelsome vociferation from the other side of the village, and being always on the alert for some sociological document, I inquired from the natives in my hut what it was. They replied that Gumgayau, a respectable and quiet man, was talking to the Baloma, spirits. I hurried to the spot, but arriving too late, found the man exhausted on his bed, apparently asleep. The incident did not arouse any excitement, because, as they said, it was his habit to talk to the Baloma. Malinowski never thought to ask his hutmates what their assumptions about spirits were, so they didn't explain. Nor did they think to ask him his assumptions about sleep and dreaming. Why should they? His assumptions, indeed, were so far from theirs that it did not occur to him that they called conversing with the spirits what he would call talking in one's sleep, even though some 20 pages later he remarked that, at times, the Baloma appear to men in dreams. In fact, later research has shown that Malinowski made quite a few mistakes stemming from the silence principle, but this is not to fault Malinowski unduly. As with the frappé, if you don't know there's a difference in assumptions, you don't know to ask for it to be explained until a misunderstanding has both occurred and been recognized as such. The problems engendered by silence are truly diabolical. Similarly, Charles Allen in Tales from the Dark Continent, 1980, remarks on an almost continual battle between African servants and their employers. It wasn't from lack of sympathy on either side. The real problem was each side had entirely different basic assumptions. Later researchers were able to go back and patch up mistakes made in understanding the Trobriand Islanders. But with myths of several millennia ago, there may be no going back. We will have lost some keys forever. Apparently, however, there is at least one type of myth which can bring some of the unmentioned social assumptions of a culture to light, namely myths of so-called trickster figures. The trickster is a plastic character who constantly plays tricks on others and predictably is not what he presents himself as. He lies, cheats, masquerades, and so on. Inasmuch as he regularly breaks the proper rules and taboos with comical and/or disastrous effects, he tells us much about what the assumed rules are. As William Hines puts it, in belief systems where entertainment is not separated from education, trickster myths can be a powerful teaching device, utilizing deeply humorous negative examples. Breaching less visible but deeply held societal values serves not only to reveal these values, but to reaffirm them. If such stories have survived, we then have a working method we could call the socialization antidote. Information on the basic and otherwise unstated assumptions of a culture may be teased out of those statements and stories by which adults socialize children. Chapter 4. More Silence. Movie Reels from Snapshots. Rationalization Syndrome. What is not known but only surmised may nonetheless be perceived and stated as known in explanation of things observed. In the story of Crater Lake, we saw a rather clear description of a volcanic eruption, complete with incandescent river, fiery boulders flying about, and ashfall. These were mixed together with equally direct statements about the life habits of spirits thought to cause such eruptions. We moderns tend to assume that the events and details in a story are all of equal value in the world, that the narrative contains either all truth or no truth. And if we don't happen to believe that volcanoes are to be explained as a mountain that a spirit is using as his home, fireplace and all, we throw the whole thing out as nonsense, instead of carefully distinguishing two quite different parts of the story, observation and explanation. And so we come up with the baby with the bathwater reflex. Heavily literate cultures tend to disregard the truth of the earlier events reported in myths and legends because they can't brook the explanations. That is, they ignore the phenomena described because they reject the mechanisms indicated. Because our language faculty is designed to tamp the world into coherent patterns or rules, explanations for itself, whether or not it has the data to do so correctly, human narratives generally contain explanations, whether or not they truly explain the observed data. The brain can supply such things quite glibly. Remember the bird and the orange. But it is often oblivious, hence silent, as to what it really knows versus what it has invented as rationalization, and it can be quite subtle about intertwining the two. The obfuscation is not necessarily deliberate. It appears that the conscious part of the brain is unaware of most of the cognitive chatter that goes on inside our heads, receiving only a final opinion or answer from this or that great network of neurons, without being privy to either the data or the probabilistic process that gave rise to that answer. Jeremy Campbell, who gives a very readable summary of how the neural network or connectionist approach to cognitive structure accounts for this problem, points out that since the non-conscious networks routinely fill in the missing parts of information that is incomplete, the version of the world that is tossed up to consciousness may be largely fictitious. And since